I want to read with you this evening from the Epistle to the Romans, and in chapter 13, the Epistle to the Romans, and in chapter 13. We shall commence to read at verse 8. Romans 13 and 8. Owe no man anything but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. And that, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armour of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envy, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof. And I'm sure the Lord will bless to us the reading of his precious word together. There are two, at least among the many, of course, but there are two outstanding hindrances to the progress of the Lord's work that, to me at least, are very evident. There is that we ought to expect, because the devil is always out to hinder the progress of the work of the Lord. That's his business. And we can expect, and we ought to be on the lookout constantly, lest he be given opportunity to hinder the Lord's work. But there is another reason that ought not to be, and one that I am very conscious might easily take possession of us, if it hasn't already taken possession of us as the assemblies of the Lord's people. And that is apathy. Apathy. There's nothing so destroying of the testimony of the Lord in any district than where the spirit of apathy creeps into an assembly. And this is the thing that I want to try and raise us to an awareness, lest we should settle to a spirit of insensitivity. When we feel that we are no longer under an obligation to the Lord. If the devil is behind the one, I'm quite sure of this, that we can look not without for the cause of the other. It's within the hearts of every one of us. It is that the flesh desires, just to be left alone. not to be disturbed or to enjoy all that the Lord has given to us. Why hasn't He given us all things freely to enjoy? But let us enjoy these without the recurring responsibilities. I feel that this is a very grave danger in my own heart and in our own assembly, and because of that I feel it finds an answer amongst us all who are thus gathered this evening. You see, the very heart of our reading speaks like this, and that knowing the time, that it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. Knowing the time, that it is high time to awake. It isn't something that's simply common to our own present point in history, or the history of the saints. This is something that has been prone to characterize the Lord's people of every age and every era. As I said, it's something that's common to human nature. And because of that, you remember as far back as the days of Haggai, when there was that little revival. And we all want to see that. All just for a little revival amongst us. But even when there was that little revival, you remember the language of Haggai, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. You see, it was evident that they took advantage of what seemed in the first instance the attack of the enemy to stop the work. It seems that they took advantage of it just to indulge in their own things. And they became apathetic to the crying out need of the hour of that particular day. And so they said, the time is not come. When all the time, it was in their experiences as it is in ours. High time. High time. Oh, they said, the time is not come. Yet the accusation of the prophet was this: is it time for you to dwell in your sealed houses? You see, it wasn't the time for building the Lord's house, but it was evidently the time for the advancing of their physical and material comfort. And if it hasn't an answer in our day and in our hearts, I just don't know. For it seems to me that where the spirit of apathy abounds, lurking close by is that desire for material advancement. And wherever this abounds, you can depend upon it that the Lord's work suffers. The things of the Lord suffer. This was, of course, the very reason why the Lord brought a blight amongst His people instead of a blessing. And maybe it is the governmental hand of God upon us that we see such barrenness amongst us today. You see, didn't the prophet give them the secret whereby the whole of this situation could be turned completely over, and instead of blight and barrenness, they could enjoy and experience the blessing of the Lord? If, says the prophet, if you'll just go up to the mountains and cut down wood and bring it to build up the house of the Lord. You see, in other words, if we would substitute, and I use that word with qualification, because there should be no need of substitution. If we would substitute the spirit of sacrifice for the spirit of apathy that reigns amongst so many of the Lord's assemblies. And this brings us to the section from which I have read. Because in these couple of chapters, 12 and 13 of the Romans, we have our responsibilities in various directions underlined for us. Whether it's in the assembly, as takes up the major part of chapter 12, or in the world, which takes up the remainder of chapter 12, or in relation to the state in the first part of chapter 13, or as in the section we read together, in relation to our responsibility to our neighbor. I say, in all of these relationships, there is first of all introduced to us that will give us the impetus for serving the Lord and living for the Lord in whatever one of these relationships, and it is the spirit of sacrifice. For that's how he introduces these chapters. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world. It's the thing, of course, that we would expect from every saint who's a real Roman, having come through in spirit all that the Lord has done in those preceding chapters. He discovers that there's only one thing that he can do. He's under moral obligation to the mercies of God to hand himself over in the spirit of complete sacrifice to God. And I well appreciate that if we really enjoy the things of the Lord, as we would sometimes suggest, as so often we audibly say, as we suggest, I say, if we enjoy them as we suggest, then there would be instinctively the glad surrender of ourselves. Of course it's our bodies here as the vehicle of expression of all that we are in the inner part of our being. We've made the decision in the presence of God, and we express it in the presentation of our bodies. I say, the spirit of apathy can never abide in such an atmosphere. And that's what I want for Forth. That's what I would want for every company represented here. But as if that weren't sufficient, that he introduces this section in this manner, in the spirit of sacrifice, at the end of the section, in this passage and in this very verse that we're trying to lift out tonight, there is an added incentive. If the one has a retrospective look, it looks back. The other has a prospective look, and he says it's high time, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. We're not only caught up with the wonders of the grace of God acting towards us as it has and bringing us into such blessings as it has, but our eyes are not in this world. Our eyes are on the other world. I think that this is absolutely vital today, that we get our eyes on the other world. That's what loosens the moorings that bind us to this world and that causes to be apathetic. Our salvation is nearer. Of course, he's not speaking about salvation as it touched our past, or even salvation as it relates to our present. He's thinking of the fullness of salvation as we shall enter upon it in the glory and with our blessed Lord. And as he contemplates that, he says, look, virtually, he says, this should give you a tenfold incentive to live in the fulfillment of all the practical issues that are before us in this passage. If there's one thing that will inevitably make me with a sense of the futility and vanity of materialism, it is an obsession with the reality in anticipation of full salvation. And so, he says, and this do, knowing the time. You see, it won't be all that difficult to discharge our debts, at least in measure, if there is in our horizon, in the near horizon of our spirits, the fact that Christ is coming at any moment, and that introducing us into the divine program of grace that shall never rest until Christ is where God intended him to be, and where we would have him be. And so he says, oh, no man anything. This question of debt, of course he's thinking of it probably in the literal sense here, but that's not always how he looks at it. He says in chapter 1, I am debtor. You see, the beloved apostle treated lightly those matters that we put such vital importance upon today. He had no place for them. You see, he was the most independent, yet dependent, of servants of the Lord. he could snap his fingers at all that the world had to offer in the light of all that he had found in Christ and all that he anticipated in Christ. And because of this, there was the constant sense of obligation in the heart of that princely little man. A sense, haven't you felt it, brother? A constant sense of obligation to others. Debtor to preach the gospel. Men and women, you owe it to them. You owe it to them out there to bring the evangel, the message of Christ to them. And of course, he recognized as he comes to chapter 8 the immensity of his debt in another direction that he would never be able to pay. And it wasn't to the flesh. It wasn't to the flesh. There are times when we would actually think that we had an obligation to the flesh. Here, of course, the obligation is not only to see that we are clear as far as our responsibility in paying our way is concerned. That is a comparatively easy thing to do. But listen, there's a debt of love that we owe that we'll never discharge. I want to underline that tonight. A debt of love that we owe, that we'll never discharge. Love to one another, of course, that's what it says. But that ye love one another. You know, I am increasingly aware that this is the chiefest of all graces, the older I become. And if we haven't got it, then the others pale into insignificance. Love for each other. It's absolutely vital, and I won't be sidetracked into speaking about it. And love to men and women. Because he says here, he that loveth the other is the word. He that loveth the other. Oh, I can see the spirit of the Samaritan here laid bare in this section. He that loveth the other, that less fortunate person, that we might, in one sense, be able to criticize and say, well, it serves him right. That's what he gets for what he's done and how he's lived. But that's not the spirit. It's he that loveth the other, loveth the other, fulfills the law. What the second part of the Decalogue demanded, but could never at any time give the ability to execute and to practice. Oh, it's within the grasp and the range of every one of us. Every one of us who loves. I hate legality, which is so hard and soul blighting, and is absolutely without compassion and mercy. Love isn't like that. There's legality in the priest and in the Levite, who left the man exactly as they found him and never moved a muscle of compassion. But I love the exhibition of it in the Samaritan, in the man that one would have thought there would be no possibility of it being exhibited. That's why the Lord uses him in this narrative. He uses him to show just exactly what is expected of those who love their neighbor. Just let me say one or two things about it, because I feel it's so absolutely essential. And the first thing that man was prepared to give in the positive sense, not only not working ill on his neighbor, but love that fulfills the law. The men that knew it were unmoved by it, but the man that never knew it, he fulfills it because of the spirit that he had. I want that spirit, I covet it. And the first thing that he gave off on that occasion, because love will always give, or it isn't love. Love gives and gives and gives. And the first thing he gave off was his time. He gave of his time. You see, here was a man, and though he was on his business, yet he had time for the other, who was his neighbor. I want to ask you, and I want to ask you absolutely seriously, without sentiment in my heart. What time do you give? What time have you for the other person? What time have you? In the matter of time, how much do you give each week? Don't for a moment speak to me about coming to the meetings. You ought to be at all the meetings. If you possibly can be there at all. I'm not thinking at the moment of meetings at all. What I am thinking of is thinking in terms of the tremendous need, the pitiful plight of men and women who are our neighbors. Well, he gave of his time. He got down off his beast and he went over to the man. And he took his time with the man. And he never left him until he was there in a safely. All that time he was willing to devote. What about my time? Or again, he gave of his treasure. That special possession that he had, he opens up his treasure and he pours in the oil and the wine. He's not at all concerned about what he has. If that man needs it, I would to God I could covet. I would covet that spirit. What do I have that I want to keep for myself? If there is the obvious crying out need and love answers the call, I say that's how we'll get it. That's how we'll get the blessing. That's how we'll make the progress. When I'm prepared not to have it for myself, that man didn't keep it for himself. He was prepared to lavish it, every part of it if necessary, in the interests of the other. But not only so, he's prepared to forego, to sacrifice his transport, his means of transport. For what did he do? He himself walked, and he made the man ride upon his beast. That's the spirit of love. What do you do with the transport media that God has given you? enjoy yourself? I say, he was prepared to sacrifice even that. And if we were, you know, let me just say something like this. Do you know of a person who's attending hospital at a particular time and has difficulty getting there? And you know, and you have the means of transport. I'm only using this as one illustration. Get there with your car. You'll find it isn't hard to talk to them about the Lord after such circumstances as these. It's transport. But we must leave it. His talents. He didn't worry about the cost, financial cost. And you know, there never was a time when we were so aware of finance as today. He didn't worry. It says there's 2 pence, 2 days wages for the average man. And he says, whatever you spend more, I'll repay thee. You get it. You see, there was no expense spared in the ministry of this man. The ministry of love, I've called it. The ministry of love to the other. To the other. And you know, that is so vitally underlined for us in this statement at the beginning. That's the kind of thing you've got to do, is the meaning. That's the kind of thing you've got to do. Why? Because it says, we're aware of the time, knowing the time. Or do we? Do we know the time? Oh, for men that have understanding of the time. Men who were like those men who came to support the cause of David. Men who had understanding of the time. Well, how do you get it? You might ask me. How is it acquired? I don't know a better illustration than Daniel. Daniel acquired the knowledge of the time when he set his face to seek his God. Sometimes I feel I'm on a play. How much do I know of the setting of my face to seek my God? I was an old man by this time. And of course, there's no ministry that old folks can so successfully carry into effect than the ministry of intercession and prayer and supplication. We may be too old to walk, but we're never too old to bend our knees in the presence of God. Oh, for men with understanding of the time. I sometimes wonder if we are aware of the time in the Lord's clock today, knowing the time, that it is high time to awake out of sleep. I wondered at that as it caught me again. To awake out of sleep. Is it possible that Christians fall asleep? It's only too possible. When I was looking at this, I turned to J.M. Davis's book, I forget the name of it, on the Epistle to the Romans, and he sets out a real number of men, and this was the very thing that brought disaster into their experiences. Great men, oh, you know, it's possible just to lose that spiritual sensitivity and to be lulled to sleep. Noah and Samson and Jonah, great men, but they were lulled to sleep by different things that came upon them. Think of the experience of those disciples when the Lord, of all occasions, is absolutely bent on their companionship in those unique moments of his in Gethsemane. And he returns just to find them asleep. Oh, the danger of sloth, my brethren, the danger of sloth. It's disobedience, the sloth of direct disobedience. I was looking just this afternoon, or the earlier part of the day, at Luke's Gospel chapter 12 and this connection. And I was quite struck by the fact that heading that section that deals with this very danger when the Lord by different means sought to instill to his own, to us, the fact that we ought to be watching, ought to be waiting, ought to be working. It's prefaced that section by, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And methinks that if our treasure was there, we would have our eyes turned thitherward. We would be really watching. And we would be like those that wait for the Lord with their loins girt and their lamps burning. That is the metaphor the Lord Jesus used. Your loins girt, not trammeled at all by things that seem to possess us, not trammeled with those, and not fumbling and stumbling our way through, but with our lamps trimmed and burning. And ye yourselves, it says, like men that wait for the Lord. Oh, I wonder, would the person next door to me be aware that I'm waiting for thee, Lord, thy beauty to see, Lord? Would they, by my disposition and demeanor, would they appreciate that fellow's waiting for something? He hasn't got it here. That's the spirit then. And of course we didn't say more about that particular section. I want just to say three things very briefly before I sit down. And that is this, knowing the time. And that word is, the Amplified puts it like this, in fact, the crisis hour, the crisis hour. You see, if we could but realize it, brethren, that we're living in a veritable crisis. And you know, when you're living in a crisis, in an emergency, then there must be emergency tactics employed and emergency measures put into operation.
And this is where I feel we miss out. We haven't recognized yet that we're living in a critical hour of the church's history. Some folks say, I would love to have been living in apostolic days when the gospel swept through. I doubt if it's a more blessed time to live than this one, when there is the faith of some failing, when the hands hang down and the knees are feeble so often. Why, what a challenge to live in the hour of crisis with the Lord's coming on the near horizon. If we just realized that, what a time we're living in, what a day of opportunity is given to us in these days. But it takes courage. It takes real courage to live in an hour like that. I was looking through 2 Timothy, and there is that very hour described for us, it seems to me. Those second epistles seem to be full of ministry for the critical hour. The critical hour. And if there's one thing that is underlined for us throughout the writings of Paul to Timothy in his second letter, it is the great need for courage. The need for courage. I don't know what Paul's experience was, what admiration one must have for that beloved princely man when he's there and every person seems to have turned against him. Aye, but he's not ashamed. He's not ashamed. His courage doesn't fail him. Don't be distressed because of the conditions that are around us. Let them be a very incentive to us to answer the challenge of the hour. You know, there is this. There's not only the crisis of it, there's a comfort of it. Think of it, brethren. The Lord may come before we are another day older, before we have another day's service given to him. It's as real as that. Oh, the blessed anticipation of meeting the Lord. And if this was just really burning in our spirits, we would be ready to answer the call of this hour, the challenge of this crisis. What a comfort it is. You beloved, aged brethren and sisters, let me comfort your hearts tonight. The Lord's near. The Lord's near. Never was as near. One of these days you're going to enter into the joy of full salvation. And if here it's been so blessed, what will it be up there? Don't let your feet drag. Don't let your spirits down. The Lord's coming. The Lord's coming. What a comfort. But what a challenge to every one of us. Now, it's high time to wake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer. Don't let us sleep. Paul spoke about that in a very similar context to this. In 1 Thessalonians 5, if the Lord's coming should be an incentive to us not to sorrow as the rest, and that's chapter 4, his coming in chapter 5 is not to sleep as the rest, not to sleep as the rest. Oh, they don't know a thing about it out there. We sometimes act as if we didn't too. We have not to sleep as the rest, as well as not to sorrow as the rest of the world.